I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now, and it's New Year's Day. Happy New Year's to you. And many of you holiday travelers are heading for the airport and home. What will you face? Well, it depends on where you're flying. Government officials say airport screening procedures will be different all across the country, and they have to be unpredictable to be effective. And what about airlines? Executives have been in constant contact with government officials over security since the Christmas Day bombing attempt, but they worry that the industry is starting a new decade with the same challenges faced after 9/11. Let's take a look ahead on this first day of 2010 with Micheline Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times. Mickey, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, Robin.
But, you know, it may be a tough weekend for some travelers, although we understand that some of the rules that quickly went into effect Christmas Day have been relaxed. Bring us up to date.
What happened on Christmas Day, obviously everyone is familiar with the incident aboard a Northwest Airlines jet, and right away the Transportation Security Administration put a bunch of rules in effect, and they mainly affected international travelers. When you travel from someplace else to the United States, you now have to show up. They're recommending 3 hours early. People are telling us that they're coming 4 hours early, and flights are still delayed because of all of these measures. You'll have at least two checks of yourself, your person, and your purse, basically. People are telling me they're even inspecting babies overseas. They'll go through your carry-on bag and take every item out. People are saying they're showing up for the plane early, then they have to wait hours to go through these checks. Yeah. There was another rule that a lot of people didn't like that actually has been relaxed somewhat, that you had to stay in your seat an hour before the plane landed. You couldn't have anything in your lap, and you had to have your bag stowed overhead.
Well, and also you couldn't get up to go to the bathroom, that meant.
Right.
And we understand the airlines were asked initially to turn off the entertainment systems in that last hour so that people couldn't see that diagram that comes up showing you where the plane is. The suspect in the Christmas incident allegedly said that's how he knew that he was getting closer to Detroit. But some of those rules have been relaxed. I think the pilots get to choose what they want to do.
Right. The captain of the ship, actually, the captain of the aircraft has flexibility in deciding. And, you know, the airline executives were telling me that that particular rule was kind of silly because everybody publishes a route map in the back of their magazines. They were also told for a little while, don't make any announcements like look out the side of the plane and you'll see Niagara Falls. But that one also has been rescinded. However, it is up to the captain, and he can tell you to stay seated. And in a sense, it's a little easier for the flight attendants to do their jobs if that's the case.
Yeah, on any day. But even before this, 2010 wasn't expected to be a good year for airlines, and yet maybe they would start gaining some ground lost in 2009. The International Air Transport Association said in December that while passenger demand would grow this year, worldwide, airlines would lose over $5 billion, $2 billion in the U.S. So what's the thinking now heading into the new year?
It's very hard to tell at this particular moment. The airlines are hoping that this is temporary. If the TSA rescinds these rules, maybe things will settle down again and we could climb back to a little bit of prosperity. Someone said to me the other day that things had kind of calmed down in the airline industry and that you could predict how your trip was going to go. I've been on planes recently where you could just show up at the normal time, zip through security. Everybody knew to take their shoes off. Everybody knew to take out their laptop. And now you won't know if you're in Sioux City or Boston what kind of security you're going to run into.
Right. Well, and just briefly, Boston's Logan Airport, where we are, announced that they're going to get one of those full-body scanner machines by January. Other airports have those puff air machines where you step inside it and it puffs air and it's supposed to detect particles on you. The scanner machine apparently has new software now, so it blurs the image a little bit so it's not so personal and violating. But in the meantime, are we seeing things like full-body pats?
Well, full-body pats are the most likely to happen, and a lot of us have been taken out of the line and given that sort of intense scrutiny, and it isn't that bad. But what I think is kind of interesting now is to see just how random all of this is, because I've been asking people at the New York Times to send me their stories about what are you encountering in security, and I've had people say, I was in North Carolina and it took me 15 minutes to get through security. So the thing is, we really don't know what it's going to be, and we really don't know what to expect.
But expect some security. Micheline Maynard, Mickey Maynard, senior business correspondent for the New York Times. Well, 2009 ended on a very somber note, but we wish the best to you in the new year.
Oh, the best to you and all of your listeners. Thank you, Robin.
Well, Garrison Keillor has stepped into a controversy again. He recently chastised Unitarians for removing references to Christ from Christmas carols. And while he was at it, he told Jews to stop writing all those cheesy carols you hear at the mall. Satire? Maybe, but it gave critics like media analysts and Unitarian Dan Kennedy an opening. He writes, "I loathe Garrison Keillor and his faux populist program, Prairie Home Companion." Ouch! But nothing that critics say about Garrison Keillor can top what he says about himself in his new novel, Pilgrim's A Woebegone Romance. In it, Gary Keillor, as they call him, accompanies residents of the fictional Lake Woebegone on a trip to Italy, where they accuse him of taking notes to put in a book and make them all look like idiots on parade. Turns out, people in Lake Woebegone, if they remember Garrison Keillor at all, don't think highly of him. Here's Marjorie Kretzbach's thoughts.
She wondered how he felt when he returned to his old hometown. Did he regret his career of self-display? Did he understand that the self he paraded was not the one everyone in Lake Woebegone remembered? To them, he was a small, dark cloud of a man given to sarcasm and ridicule, a man of false humility, covering enormous self-regard. But on the radio, he was jovial and winsome, pal to the people, celebrator of home and family and heartland and hard work. He was an ace at the classic American game of playing dumb, an educated man pretending to be a simple peasant, the oldest dodge in the books, the secret of demagogues and flim-flam men since time immemorial.
Hardly. Garrison Keillor just celebrated the 35th anniversary of Prairie Home Companion, and in 2009 published three books, 77 Love Sonnets, A Christmas Blizzard, and Pilgrims, in which residents of Lake Woebegone go to Rome to honor a World War II hero who turns out to be not so heroic. And as we just heard, neither does Garrison Keillor. We spoke to him recently. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin. Good to be here.
Well, what's going on here? Residents of Lake Woebegone either flat out not liking you in this book or they're just not getting you?
Well, there's a lot of things happening. I suppose that envy and jealousy are mixed in there as well. But Lake Woebegone is a democracy. It's a powerful democracy. And they believe in bringing people down to size. And don't think you're bigger than anybody else or more important than anybody else. And when they cut you down to size, they cut you off at the knees.
I know.
They're merciless.
As you're touring Rome with them, one suggests you see a doctor about that nasal blockage.
Right.
Another muses out loud that, you know, she listens sometimes to your show and she hears you murmur stories about a gloomy town she doesn't recognize at all, full of righteous yokels addicted to tuna hot dish.
Yes.
I'm wondering, do you ever hear from people who say that you are mocking small towns?
I tend not to hear from those people. I'm sure there are people who feel that way. The people I know who still live in small towns are very funny talking about their own neighbors, telling me things they would never say to their neighbors. People who live in small towns tend not to be reverent about each other. They know each other much too well. The reason for writing a novel, however, is to find out more about characters whom one has introduced who are shadowy figures. Margie Kretzbach, for years, appeared on the Lake Woebegone News on Prairie Home just as a shadowy figure married to Carl Kretzbach. She was simply a name, and I was curious about her. Mm. And so the way for me to find out about her is to write a novel in which she is the protagonist.
Well, and what we find out...
Robin Young. I could write a novel about a woman named Robin Young. If I started to meditate on this, you know... I could write you up, kid.
Yeah, well, it'd probably be more exciting than it really is. In Marjorie's case, She is going to Rome to try to honor a woebegone hero, a World War II hero. And what she discovers through some letters that she finds and contact she makes with a daughter that he had is that he wasn't as heroic as everyone in Lake Woebegone thought. And also her secondary story seems to be that she's trying to wake up her marriage.
Yes, and she's embarrassed, Margie Krebsbach, because she hasn't gone anywhere. I mean, she looks at me with disdain because she doesn't like a Prairie Home Companion, but here she is, and she is still teaching English in the high school that she attended as a kid. She hasn't gone anywhere. She wants to get out of town.
Well, and as you said, she's not a fan of Gary Keeler's, as they call him. But Gary Keeler isn't either in the book. I mean, he writes at one point, it wasn't talent, but a lack of social skills that made him a writer. And we were wondering about, you know, very self-effacing. And then we read a sonnet in your other new book from this past year, 77 Love Sonnets by Garrison Keeler. It's called Radio Man. Do you happen to have that in front of you?
I think I know that one by heart.
I'm
a radio man for 35 years doing an old variety show based on some I used to hear when I was your age years ago. Critics pointed out my debts to Bob and Ray and Fibber McGee, but alcohol and cigarettes swept those critics out to sea and to 20-year-olds who were born too late to hear the great Fred Allen. I'm the inventor of the form, sailing the airwaves like Magellan. A thief who escapes and is not hung may yet be honored by the young.
Well, and that made us wonder, again, tied to the Gary Keeler that we meet in the novel, who nobody much likes and they think is kind of false image. Is Garrison Keeler, are you feeling a little bit like a fraud?
No. I am a performer, and I'm a performer who was not really cut out for this life, but I fell into it, and I felt very lucky from the moment I fell into it, because I didn't really see any other prospects. And so I landed in this job for which I'm, you know, completely unqualified. And by being unqualified, I've managed to turn this into a whole lifetime of work, you see. It's dissatisfaction with your own work, and it's a feeling that you haven't done what you set out hoping to do that keeps you at it.
Garrison Keeler of Public Radio's Prairie Home Companion, helping us ring in the new year, giving us the strength to get up and do what needs to be done, like his powder milk biscuits. After a break, we want to ask about his health. He began this year with a stroke. Later, what a difference a decade makes, the changes in what we eat. Back in a minute, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back to our conversation with Garrison Keeler, who published three books at the end of 2009. One, a story about the fictional residents of Lake Woebegone, including Marjorie Krebsbach, who goes to Rome to reawaken her marriage. Another is a novella called A Christmas Blizzard. The third, a collection of sonnets, 77 sonnets to be exact. And of course, Garrison still does his weekly radio program, Prairie Home Companion, which we complimented him on. Wow, what a great show you had on Saturday.
It had its points, and this Russian choral director started telling this story about the rooms. And I have the news from Lake Woebegone to do, and I'm suddenly down to 12 minutes and 11 minutes. The audience is starting to get worried because they can see a clock running, and they finished this song about brooms, Viniki. And I just talked off the top of my head. I just talked as fast as I could until I had 2 minutes left, and I did a fast credits, and you know, a holy night. The stars were brightly shining.
Hey, live radio.
Yeah, live radio.
You know, one of my colleagues in reading the books said, wow, he also seems so preoccupied with death and topics like that. And maybe it's because he had a minor stroke in September. We should ask him about that. And I said, well, actually, I've spoken to him quite a few times. He's always been this way. But did that kind of brush in September make you look even harder at issues like death, which you do, especially in the sonnets?
It should have, but it didn't really, because I realized when I arrived at the emergency room how lightly I had gotten off. This blood clot came shooting out of an atrium and up into my brain, but it landed in a part of my brain where not a whole lot is going on. And I may have more of that sort of brain territory than most people, you know, kind of the, I don't know, the northern territories of the brain, the Saskatchewan of the brain. And so I just had a slight slurring of speech. When you look around at other people who had strokes, oh my gosh, you realize, you know, that you averted catastrophe, and you know, you're like somebody who took part in Pickett's last charge, and you came away with a sprained ankle. And there are bodies lying out there in the sun at Gettysburg, and you limp away and sit down under a tree, and you're supposed to feel fortunate.
Yeah. Well, and we're glad to hear all of that. what is it about the sonnet form that appeals to you? Because I think you said that it was Shakespeare's sonnet number 29 that influenced you.
It dawned on me a few years ago that of all the things I had learned or thought I had learned in junior high school, all of it had left my brain. Biology and geometry and mathematics. But the sonnet that Helen Fleischman required me to memorize was still up there. When in disgrace with fortune and men's eyes, I all alone beweep my outcast state, and trouble deaf heaven with my bootless cries, and think upon myself and curse my fate. It still was up there. It appeals to me, too, because it's 14 lines, and you discover oftentimes that 14 lines is enough. You thought you had a lot to say, but when you sat down and you wrote 14 lines, that seemed to be enough.
Well, Garrison Keillor, one of your sonnets is called January. It is January. May we hear that as we close?
Of course you may. Another year gone, and the old man with the sigh is mowing closer. He hasn't been subtle, has he? Too many good people gone, and I could sit and cry for them. Except that you look exceptionally snazzy and sexy, despite the miles on your odometer, as if you have a few more aces up your sleeve. Maybe you were born under a lucky commodore. Maybe it's just the delirium of New Year's Eve. I gaze in your face and take your hand. You're positively glowing. Maybe we've been sorry a long enough time, and now we get some grandeur and do our dance and sing our aria. May the new year bring us, before it has flown, all we would have wished for, had we only known.
You know, I'm thinking that that's a sonnet that could have been written by Marjorie Krebsbach, your Lake Wobegon resident who goes to Rome and, you know, reawakens the feelings in her husband.
She looks at Karl Krebsbach, and he does look snazzy and sexy to her. And she believes in the possibility of renaissance in marriage. And so do I.
That's Garrison Keillor. We heard him reading from 77 Love Sonnets. We've also been talking about his book, Pilgrims, A Woebegone Romance. And this year he also wrote A Christmas Blizzard. Garrison Keillor, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Happy New Year to you, by the way.
And also to you.
Okay, looking ahead, Monday on Here and Now, why states are starting programs to help inner-city grocery stores sell fresh fruits and veggies. Also, what would Ambrose write as in Ambrose Bierce? We'll look back at some of this wordsmith's pet peeves. That's Monday. The latest news is next, Here and Now. The new film Avatar is another box office hit for director James Cameron. It comes a dozen years after his last movie, Titanic, became the top-grossing movie of all time. Almost every frame of Avatar has been visually manipulated to an extent unseen before, and it's all in 3D. The BBC's Vincent Dowd reports.
In the 21st century, a weapon will be invented like no other. Arnold Schwarzenegger is the Terminator.
When, in 1984, a young writer-director called James Cameron made The Terminator with Arnold Schwarzenegger and Linda Hamilton, it might easily have turned out straight-to-video sci-fi junk. Instead, it made Cameron's career, and already his defining interest was evident.
Cameron's affections for technology are visible on the screen and they are visible behind the camera.
U.S. academic Alexandra Keller has written a book about the Canadian-born Cameron. She says the fascination with technology runs from the Terminator then to Avatar today.
He will often write a script and he will have to sit on it and wait until the technology becomes available that will bring that script as he has written it to the screen. And he will have no compromise on this. And what typically happens is he is the one who invents the technology that he needs.
Jake, it's crazy here.
We're going up against gunships with bows and arrows.
Avatar takes place in the year 2154 on the moon Pandora. Cameron has spent over $200 million producing convincing computer-manipulated imagery way ahead of anything we've seen before. The hero is a US Marine who comes to question if we have the right or indeed the ability to dominate alien peoples.
I became a Marine for the hardship. All I ever wanted was a single thing worth fighting for.
Ladies and gentlemen, you are not in Kansas anymore. You are on Pandora.
In the film, we see mainly computerized versions of actors, their original movements reproduced using motion capture technology. So doesn't that prove what's often said of Cameron, that he's more interested in pushing the boundaries of technology than in performance? Alexandra Keller thinks not.
Cameron's relationship to his actors, I think, is a very complicated one. This is the question of the actor being a nuisance, which is also a question often asked of George Lucas. Basically, you could replace an actor with some kind of computer-generated version. On the other hand, twice now, Cameron has married one of his actors. He married Linda Hamilton, and then he married Susie Amis, who was one of the performers in Titanic.
But the big movie industry hope and possibly hype is that Avatar will prove the breakthrough for a technology for which Hollywood has great expectations. Louise Tutt of trade magazine Screen International.
The film industry very much wants 3D to work because it preserves the premium theatrical cinema-going experience. Distributors and exhibitors can charge a higher ticket price. That's important because more and more people are watching films on DVD. Cinema going is expensive. And the studios and the distributors, they want to preserve this cinema going experience.
But the marketing emphasis on 3D has another aim, finally to frustrate a global phenomenon which obsesses the movie industry, the manufacture of pirate DVDs.
I mean, that's the holy grail, especially in regions like Asia where there's a huge percentage of piracy. The hope is that a film like Avatar, the marketing and the promotion around it is that you have to see it at the cinema and that word of mouth will propel people to the cinema and it will scupper the pirates.
It's not likely James Cameron's Avatar will ever match the $1.8 billion Titanic made at the box office. But the film industry hopes the innovative technology it showcases will help defeat movie piracy worldwide. And for Hollywood, that would be victory enough.
Well, we will send them a message.
That this is our land!
That report from the BBC's Vincent Dowd. This reminder, you can listen to our show stream live at our website, hereandnow.org, where you can also download a podcast. Take us with you when you go. And we'll be back in a bit. Have you gone back to your corner coffee shop instead of the fancy chains? You're not alone. We'll look at the changes in what we eat and drink here and now. Think back over the decade with us to 1999. What were you eating and drinking then? That's exactly what our next guest, Leslie Anderson, did, and she discovered that what we eat has a lot to do with the economy. Leslie Anderson is senior editor at the food site Chow.com. She joins us, and Leslie, take us back to the 90s, the height of the dot-com craze. What were the food trends then?
In 1999, the name of the game was how much can you impress your neighbor, your friend, your venture capitalist? It was all about getting, you know, the right table at the most prestigious restaurant. It was fine linens. And at these dot-com parties, there were mountains of prawns and vodka flowing through ice luges and martini glasses with wasabi mashed potatoes and things that really reflected the hubris of the time.
So a lot of shrimp, food piled high. We remember that was a trend then, that you had to have a tower of food on your plate. What were we drinking?
We were drinking vodka. And that vodka is an interesting thing because it symbolizes how people really fetishized high technology, because vodka is about the most high-tech drink you can possibly drink. I mean, it's been synthesized within an inch of its life, so it has no aroma, no flavor, no texture to speak of. And we were drinking it by the gallonful. You know, there were Cosmos inspired by Sex and the City. There were apple teenies that were the color and smell and taste of Jolly Ranchers. It was really just about as far from nature as you can get in a glass.
Well, you know, I just realized something. I said, what were we drinking? I don't think I've ever had vodka in my life. And I can I can hear listeners saying, well, wait a second, who's this we? You know, you're based in San Francisco. I'm wondering, is this sort of an observation of 1999 through the eyes of high-tech people in San Francisco and, let's say, New York?
Well, I have to say that I was in the middle of the dot-com boom, but I did travel a lot to New York and Los Angeles. This was what was going on in those three cities, yeah. And I think it kind of percolated up to other parts of the country.
If you went to, you know, chain restaurants in the middle of the country, you got more shrimp than you could ever get at any other time in your life, because we've reported on this, actually, because Americans were demanding it, so it was being farmed in places like Japan, and shrimp was suddenly cheap.
Absolutely. And now, fast forward 10 years, according to the World Wildlife Fund, by 2012, bluefin tuna, which is the most prized type of tuna for sushi, is going to be extinct if we continue to fish it at the same rate that we're currently fishing it. So 10 years ago, everybody was eating sushi. It was the hot food. Now, you have to carry around one of those little cards that tell you, you know, what's the right kind of fish to eat and what are you supposed to ask your fishmonger. It's very hard to keep track of.
Well, and shrimp farms, we now know, are recognized as bad for the environment. They're also not so great for the taste of the shrimp itself. Tell us more. What other shifts do you see 10 years later from 1999, and what does that tell you?
Sure. The trend in dining is a more humble, earthy experience. The restaurants that you see popping up, first of all, have names like Spork, Flour and Water, Dirt Candy, Fish and Farm, as opposed to 10 years ago, the names of the restaurants were things like, I kid you not, Paragon, Vertigo, MC Squared, The Globe.
One of my favorites is Cellador, and I asked someone, gee, Cellador, what does that mean? He said, well, it used to be a cellar door. But you're saying so people are getting more down to the earth? And you mentioned restaurants popping up. There's literally something called a pop-up restaurant.
Yes. It's when a chef basically decides he wants to cook for a night at somebody else's restaurant, spreads the word through Twitter and Facebook, and then you feel like you're in the know because, oh, so-and-so chef is cooking at the upstairs of this bar on Wednesday nights. So that's the so-called pop-up restaurant. And also popular now are things that we used to call roach coaches 10 years ago, which is street food. Chefs going out and creating wonderful versions of the, you know, classic hot dog cart. You've got gourmet hot dog carts. You've got French food coming out of a truck like escargot on skewers and all kinds of new street cart schemes.
Well, and we're sorry that you reminded us of what we used to think of those things. But now, sure, buying food on not just the street, but farmers markets is incredibly popular. And you take that even further, you make another comparison between the 90s, where, as you said, eating tons of free food piled up at dot-com launch parties. Now you've got freeganism and gleaning. What's that?
Eating everything that's free. They try not to actually buy any food. So they're dumpster diving. They're stealing fruit from their neighbors' trees. They're eating over at their friends' houses. They're trying to see how long they can go without paying for food.
Well, and again, can you draw a line from 99 to 2009 and the changes in food behaviors to the economy?
Absolutely. In 1999, few people were cooking because they were eating actually at their desks, and work was catering their meals. Now, in 2009, 2010, people are out of work, and they have to learn how to cook. And so we've seen this astounding boom in cookbook sales.
Is it? I mean, again, I can hear people saying, well, who's this we that was eating on our desk as part of the dot-com boom? This seems like a very sort of fringe of the country kind of phenomenon. Where else do you see it sort of becoming more mainstream? I'm thinking of maybe organic foods.
That's a really interesting thing to look at. In 1999, it was pretty difficult to get organic produce unless you lived in one of those coastal cities. And now organics are at Walmart.
Well, do you think that this is because of the economy or because of evolution? We've evolved. We're smarter.
I think in the last 10 years, there's been so much information that's come out about the way that our food systems affect global warming, for instance. You know, how far does a pineapple have to travel to get to your door? And so I think that people are starting to not only look at how can they be healthier, but how can they help the planet? How can they vote with their fork by what they choose to eat?
Well, that's Leslie Anderson, senior editor at Chow.com. They've taken a look back a decade to see how much we've changed in how we eat and drink. Leslie, it's fascinating. We'll hook people up to your site at oursherenow.org. Look a little further ahead for us. What do you see even on the horizon?
Well, this might be scary to some people that like to eat meat, like myself, but there was a very interesting report that came out from the World Bank about how livestock farming is responsible for half of all greenhouse gases. That was really startling, frightening, and I think will have tremendous impact going forward.
What else?
More examples of small artisanal businesses, people that just specialize in making the best roll possible, or somebody that makes the most fabulous caramel you'll ever eat, and that will shop for these things in dedicated shops, sort of like the cliche French housewife that goes from shop to shop.
Wait a minute, doesn't that get us back to the 1990s? Here we go again. But I see what you're saying, more locally produced food. Leslie Anderson, again, at chow.com. Thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Robin. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thoughts? We'd love to hear them. Go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email or scroll down and leave a comment right there. You can also follow us on Twitter at hereandnow. When we come back, the sensitive female chord progression that guys play too, Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Skoll Foundation, supporting social entrepreneurs around the world, uncommon heroes dedicated to the common good. Learn more at skoll.org.
Welcome back. And as we welcome the new year, we wonder, are there going to be even more songs with the sensitive female chord progression? In 1998, entertainment writer Mark Hirsch noticed that Sarah McLachlan's Building a Mystery sounded an awful lot like Joan Osborne's 1995 hit, One of Us. If God had a name, what would it be? And then, this past summer, along came Beyoncé with the same chord progression in the ubiquitous If I Were a Boy.
If I were a boy, even just for a day.
Mark calls it the sensitive female chord progression, which guys can play too. At least one of our listeners thought it was silly. He said all Western music is built on chord progressions. But most of you loved it, and some had your own names for it. Bridget Madden calls it the romantic comedy montage, during which the heroine transitions from bad old boyfriend to good new boyfriend. See what you think. Here again, Mark Hirsch's sensitive female chord progression.
I kick it with who I wanted, and I never get confronted for it, 'cause they stick up for me.
I've been thinking about it for years as minor 6, major 4, major 1, major 5. But as many Berklee students have pointed out, it is more accurately designated as minor 1, major 6, major 3, flat 7.
Well, but if you don't know anything about any of that,
of course,
and you're speaking of Berklee School of Music students who do know all about that, you say you can just sing Joan Osborne's, What If God Were One of Us, over any song, just to see if it has the chord progression.
That is correct.
So let's do this. Let's listen to Joan Osborne again with One of Us, and as it goes along, you know, tell me where the chord changes are, okay, for the uninitiated, for the non-musician, okay?
Okay. Yeah. Here's the minor 6, the major 4, the major 1, the major 5.
Okay.
Minor 6, major 4, major 1, major 5.
Okay.
And so forth.
Okay. Now, here's what I want to do now. If we could cue up in there, we're driving everyone crazy on the other side of that glass. If we could just cue up Sarah McLachlan, okay? Now, I want you to sing Joan Osborne with me over Sarah McLachlan.
Me to sing,
okay, yes.
What if God was one of us?
That's when the energy comes.
Just a slob like one of us.
Vampires roam.
Just a stranger. Oh, that's the part that switches.
Okay.
That's
that was amazing for as far as it went. You talked to Eric Bazillion of the Hooters, who wrote One of Us that Joan Osborne sings, that you say just like owns this female chord progression. He's a guy. What did he say to you?
As soon as he called me back when I requested an interview, the message they left on my voicemail was excitement that somebody else had finally spotted this thing that he's been living with for 10 years, because he had noticed this exact same phenomenon, just song after song after song. And he certainly doesn't feel as though he needs to get everybody that has used this chord progression, because
right.
He's certainly not the first one to use it either.
But you talk to other people, too, about what it might be doing, you know, and especially since, men use it as well. Well, there's the man who wrote it, Eric Bazillion. But also, Green Day's Holiday. Let's just take a listen.
What if God was one of us?
That was one of us. So, you know, guys using it, too. But what do you think specifically it does for women? Because that was definitely a different feel with Green Day. So what is it doing, you know, that you call it this, you know, female chord progression?
First of all, it's important to realize that the reason I gave it that name was that the songs that I was hearing that fit this chord progression were all women. And specifically, they were all women who would be on stage at a Lilith Fair.
I was
they
just
were
gonna say Lilith
Joan
Fair,
Osborne,
right.
Sarah McLachlan, Melissa Etheridge, Jewel used it, and then Nina Gordon, who used to be in Veruca Salt, which was a very hard rock band. She made her pop move using this chord progression with a song called Tonight and the Rest of My Life.
I hear it.
Now, over the years, there have been plenty of songs that have completely violated the name Sensitive Female Chord Progression.
Right.
One of the more aggressive ones is The Offspring, and you can listen to the song Self-Esteem, which is one of the big ones that sort of helped make their name in 1994.
talk to musicologists about what this progression might be doing, you know, as opposed to, you know, something that just does a crescendo and stays up on the crescendo. This is kind of a circular thing. What do people tell you?
One of the reasons why I'm sure it works the way it does and it's so popular, it continues to come up over and over again, and the reason why I was corrected by a lot of Berkeley students when I officially got it wrong, is that when you look at it as minor 6, major 4, major 1, major 5, those are essentially the four most basic chords for pop music in the last 50 years. And you can rearrange those in whatever order you want and get a large proportion of all the songs that we've listened to mm-hmm. over the last half century. You can start them at different points and get different songs. There's a comedian named Rob Paravonian who has something that a lot of people have seen on YouTube called Pachelbel Rant. He basically starts in the middle of My Sensitive Female chord progression. I start on the minor 6, he starts on the major 1, and he plays guitar, and it's part of his act, and he goes through a number of songs that go major 1, major 5, minor 6, major 4. Wow, it's been good living with you. And my machine head is better than the rest. My machine head is better than the... See the stone set in her eye. See the thorn twist in her... I'm all out of faith. This is how I feel. I'm cold and I'm chained. Lying naked on the floor. He was a boy. She was a girl. Could it be any more obvious? We're not gonna take it. No, we ain't gonna take it. On your mark, get set, and go now. Got a dream and we just know now. No. And if you start this progression in another spot, if you start it at the major 4, you get Rihanna's Umbrella, you get Oasis' Supersonic.
Oh.
So it's basically, if you look at it as just one never-ending circle, you can almost start it at any spot and get a song.
What shall we go out with here? I want it to be rousing. Well, how about Beyoncé? And then we can sing along with her.
If I could sing along with Beyoncé,
right.
Then I...
Your day is complete.
My day would be complete, yes.
That's entertainment writer Mark Hirsch speaking about the sensitive female chord progression that guys play too. Mark, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for having me.
Okay, hit it. 'Cause they stick up for me. If I was
one of us. Just as soft like one of us.
Everybody.
Building a mystery.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI. I'm Robin Young, so off we go into the new year. Day one, not so bad. Have a great weekend, and please join us again here and now. When you lose the one you wanted, 'cause he's taking you for granted,
and everything you had got destroyed. Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.